Okay, good morning. This is Bio 241, and we're almost done with muscle chapter today. We're looking at excitation, contraction, coupling, looking at various membrane proteins on the sarcolemma, which is the cell membrane of a skeletal muscle cell. And on this slide, we see very nicely the neuromuscular junction, okay, and the motor end plate. And what kind of synapse is this right here? It's a nice chemical synapse, so this axon terminus has to release a chemical signaling agent that moves across the synaptic cleft, and it has to bind to something on the postsynaptic membrane, which is a... What does the neurotransmitter have to bind to on the postsynaptic membrane? A receptor, yeah? And it's a ligand-gated channel, right? So it's a ligand-gated channel, so as soon as acetylcholine binds to this channel, it opens up a sodium channel, sodium enters the cell, and what happens to the cell then when sodium enters? Yeah, it depolarizes, which is an excitatory event. One thing that's interesting about skeletal muscle cells, not only do they have ligand-gated channels in the neuromuscular junction, okay, or very close to it, it also has voltage-gated channels, right, which is different compared to a neuron, because anywhere on a neuron, like the dendrite and cell body, there aren't voltage-gated channels. What part of a neuron has a voltage-gated channel? Only axons do, right? So that's a difference. So as soon as the somatic motor neuron excites the muscle cell, it opens these voltage-gated channels, which initiates what? It starts what? Right in the neuromuscular junction. An action potential, right? An action potential. And what can you tell me about action potentials? How do they travel? Without decrement, they never fade away, and the whole cell membrane has voltage-gated channels, so an action potential flows over the whole cell surface, right? So it excites the whole cell. So a skeletal muscle cell can never make up its mind whether or not it's going to start an action potential or not. Every time, right, a nerve impulse reaches an axon terminus right here, the skeletal muscle cell will develop an action potential that flows over the whole cell, including down the T-tubules that we looked at last time, because T-tubules contain voltage-gated channels, which also explains something else, right? That when you touch an electrical socket, what happens to skeletal muscles? Like if you get a jolt of electricity from an electrical socket or a power cord to your toaster that is losing insulation on it, or maybe a light bulb in your house, a lamp in your house. When you touch something electrical, what happens to your skeletal muscles? They contract, right? Because what kind of membrane channels do skeletal muscles have? Voltage-gated channels, right? And when you apply a voltage to your body, it opens those channels and it causes this excitation, contraction, coupling scheme to operate that we're talking about. Okay, normally it's under control of neurotransmitter through the neuromuscular junction. Okay, so you have an action potential flowing over the sarcolemma, down including into the T-tubules right here. And when the voltage changes in this T-tubule, it excites another kind of voltage-gated channel. And it's this one right here. Okay, so there are sodium-gated channels in the T-tubule. And these are actually calcium. These are coupled to a calcium channel. All right, that's in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So here is the terminal cisternae of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And what's the job of sarcoplasmic reticulum? It stores calcium, right? So there's high calcium inside this organelle, low calcium within the cytosol or the myofibril. And when this DHP receptor is stimulated due to depolarization, it automatically pulls on this ryanodine receptor, which is in the membrane of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And when it gets pulled, that's just like you pushing a door open. This is a calcium channel, and calcium then moves by diffusion from this terminal cisternae into the myofibril. And then what does that calcium do? It's not on this slide, but don't forget what it does. What does calcium do when it's floating around all these myofilaments? It binds to something. What does it bind to? It binds to a chemical compound that's similar to calmodulin, but it's called troponin, right? And then troponin causes tropomyosin to get out of the way, because troponin normally covers up the myosin binding sites. But when calcium binds to troponin, tropomyosin gets out of the way so that a myosin head group can bind to an actin molecule, and that stimulates cross-bridge cycling, which then moves these filaments to slide over each other, and it contracts a sarcomere. All right, so you got a DHP receptor, which is a voltage-gated protein, and then you have the ryanodine receptor, which is coupled to that electrical receptor. So sometimes we call this an electrical mechanical receptor complex, which opens up the calcium channel on the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And then there's something else that happens too. As calcium starts to flood the cell, there's another kind of membrane channel, which I'm not sure people exactly know how it operates, so I don't really want to call it a ligand-gated channel, but if when calcium starts to increase in the myofibril, it opens up other calcium-induced calcium channels. So other calcium channels open up. So not only do you have the this ryanodine receptor opening up calcium channels, you also have the calcium-induced calcium channels open up, and then there's a huge flood of calcium into the myofibril that binds to all of the troponin molecules on an actin molecule, and it causes then the sliding of these myofilaments. Okay, so that's what's on these two slides right here. All right, so sometimes we call that electromechanical release. So you've got the two calcium channels that open up. Okay, you've got the ryanodine receptor that allows calcium, and also the calcium-induced calcium channels, which then flood the myofibril with calcium. And then that gets tropomyosin out of the way so that cross bridges can cycle. All right, so this is a pretty good exam figure. So appreciate the difference between a neuron and a muscle cell in terms of what kind of membrane proteins are in the plasma membrane that can cause excitation. So here's a little flowchart that outlines excitation contractioning coupling for you. So what kind of neuron controls skeletal muscle? This is a somatic motor neuron, right? It's not an efferent neuron. It's a motor neuron, efferent neuron. And somatic because it's going to skeletal muscle, so we're not considering smooth muscle right now. And that kind of neuron releases, that's a cholinergic neuron, right? Because what does it release? Acetylcholine. And then acetylcholine then binds to these nicotinic receptors. So two molecules of acetylcholine have to bind to this receptor. That's a ligand-gated channel. And sodium diffuses in, causing depolarization. That's an excitatory stimulus to the cell. And you also have voltage-gated channels in that same area so that when the cell depolarizes, that starts an action potential that sweeps over the whole sarcolemma, including down into the interior of the cell. How does an action potential get down into the interior of a skeletal muscle cell if the sarcolemma is just on the outside? Yeah, through those T-tubules, the transverse tubules, right? So action potential flows not only on the surface of the cell, but throughout the interior of the cell. And when it does that, these action potentials open voltage-gated calcium channels. That's the DHP receptor, and it's named after an exogenous chemical, a chemical that's applied for experimental purposes that will stimulate this receptor right here. That's why it was called a DHP receptor. But that is a voltage-gated channel, okay, which then causes calcium release channels in the SR to open. And which way is calcium going to move? From the myofibril into the sarcoplasmic reticulum or from the sarcoplasmic reticulum into the myofibril? Yeah, it's going to go down concentration gradient or into the myofibril, and that's going to stimulate additional calcium channels to open up, which are the calcium-induced calcium release channels, and these are huge. These are 10 times the diameter of a normal channel. And what happens to the flow of a material through a tube, consider a tube, what happens to the flow of a material through a tube when the tube dilates? I think you're starting to talk about this in lab, at least some labs. What happens to flow through a tube when the radius of the tube increases? Does it increase or decrease? It increases by a little bit or a lot. By a lot, right? And we're going to talk about this in the next couple chapters in lecture. By the fourth power, right? So if there's a small change in diameter, that still can be, that still produces a large change in flow. And if the diameter changes by 10 times, a factor of 10, what? That's a huge difference, right? Okay, so that's a huge difference. So calcium just floods the whole myofibril. binds to troponin, and that stimulates contraction because then that troponin-calcium complex moves tropomyosin out of the way, and you can have Crossbridge's cycle. And if you want to see a video on that, there are a number of good videos in Blackboard. Okay. Muscle relaxation, on the other hand, occurs when calcium, after it is diffusing through the myofibril, gets pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So the concentration starts to decrease. Right? And when that happens, then troponin releases calcium into the myofibril, and then it's pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And if there is not another action potential causing opening of any calcium channels, then these calcium pumps pump calcium to sufficiently low levels so Crossbridges can't cycle, right? And that causes the muscle to relax. But as you can imagine, this takes a little bit of time. And so muscle contracts for a relatively long period of time. And we're going to see that it also causes another phenomena, which is on these next couple slides right here, which is called summation. And if you have a number of muscle contractions that are coming together close enough in time, that can also cause a condition called tetanus. All right, so here we have a graph of the tension that is produced by a muscle fiber versus time. So the axis on this graph right here is, is not shown, but make sure that you realize that this is not looking at membrane voltage right here. This is actually looking at the tension that a muscle fiber is producing versus time. It sort of looks like an action potential, but it's not. It's just the amount of tension. So muscle is stimulated, starts to contract, it produces tension, right? And then it starts to relax. But if before the first muscle twitch completely relaxes, if you stimulate this muscle cell again, right, notice the second contraction is at a little bit higher tension. And so this is what we call summation. All right, so how is it that a muscle is producing tension? What happens inside the cell that produces tension, a muscle fiber? All right, so a muscle twitch is just the contraction that a single muscle fiber produces. How does it produce that? How does it produce that tension? What's happening? Yeah, the cross bridges are cycling, which means what, actin and myosin are sliding over each other. And what's the signaling molecule from the sarcoplasmic reticulum that is causing cross-bridge cycling so that the filaments can slide over each other? Yeah, it's that calcium molecule, right? So it takes a little while for calcium to get pumped back completely into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. But if you stimulate a muscle while there's still a little bit of calcium in the myofibril, right, so now you have even more calcium in the myofibril, so it contracts at a little bit higher intensity, right? And so this is what we call summation. Right. So this is just for an individual muscle cell. And every muscle cell will contract to 100% of its ability. Right. And that's only directly related to the amount of calcium that's inside the myofibril. But a muscle like the biceps brachii, right, which contains thousands of muscle fibers, can undergo a graded contraction. Right. So make sure you know the difference between a muscle twitch that is going to contract at 100% of its ability versus a graded contraction that a whole muscle can produce. And because a whole muscle is made out of hundreds or thousands of muscle fibers or muscle cells, and the biceps brachii will contract very weakly if only one of those muscle cells contracts, right? But if 100 will contract, then it will produce 100 times the amount of tension, right? So there is a big difference in tension that a muscle like the biceps can produce, and that's what we call a graded potential, depending on what motor units are recruited, right, by somatic motor neurons going to that particular muscle. All right, so a twitch is just one contraction summation if the twitches come very close together in time. All right, so here we see, if we take a muscle cell and we stimulate it at 5 shocks per second, right? So we have a number of muscle twitches, and you can see summation taking place, and then eventually there's so much calcium inside the myofibrils that they hardly relax at all, right? So it reaches this plateau. We call this incomplete tetanus, when the muscle cell still relaxes a little bit before the next stimulating event comes along. All right, but if we increase the number of shocks to this muscle, we'll double it to 10 shocks per second. Now the muscle fiber doesn't have any time to relax at all, so it reaches plateau, so it sums, right, of these muscle twitches sum together and reaches a plateau very early on, and now I don't see hardly any relaxation at all between muscle shocks, and so this is what we call complete tetanus, right, when the muscle is just completely contracted because the frequency of electrical stimulation is too high, right? So no relaxation takes place. All right, sometimes we call this effect, this staircase effect, TREPA right here. So, and that just is due to the frequency of exogenous shocking on this particular muscle due to electrical activity. All right, but if we keep that stimulus applied for a long period of time, the muscle goes into tetanus, but after a certain period of time, then the muscle starts to get weaker and weaker and weaker and weaker, even though we keep the stimulus applied to a muscle. We call that fatigue. And fatigue has is a result of a number of things. Okay, what does what's the energy source for muscle contraction? It's ATP, right? And so when a muscle is contracting, it's using up ATP. So when it starts to run out of ATP, the muscle is going to start to fatigue. But also, that ATP is being produced by primarily glycolysis within the myofibril. And if oxygen can't get to that muscle, when the muscle is contracted, blood can't flow into it, so it's running out of oxygen, what kind of metabolism is making that ATP? Glycolysis, when no oxygen is not present, is what? What kind of respiration is producing that ATP? Aerobic or anaerobic? Yeah, so it's anaerobic respiration, and the end molecule for anaerobic respiration is not just pyruvate, but what? Lactic acid, right? And so the key term there is acid. So as the muscle becomes more acidic, then it's less able to produce tension when it's contracting. Okay, so as the muscle becomes more acidic, it fatigues. Okay, so that's what that fatigue is for. All right, here's a really important concept. So make sure you read over this in your textbook, and I maybe need, you've got some good figures. I don't think I have to draw anything out. But it's a length-tension relationship in muscle. And this is an important relationship because it will tell you how strong a muscle can contract, and which is the tension that is produced by muscle. It's going to be determined by the length of sarcomeres, or the length of a muscle, when it starts to contract. All right, so here is a nice list of things that help determine what kind of tension can be produced by muscle, and what's the overall job of a muscle? What is muscle specialized to do? To contract, right, and produce tension. So this tension right here is really what muscles are designed to provide for us. All right, so the strength of a muscle contraction or tension is influenced by what we just saw in the previous slide, the frequency of stimulation. Right, so if the frequency of stimulation is really slow, then we don't have any summation, and the muscle won't even, will just contract and then relax. As the frequency increases, right, we have summation, and if the frequency of stimulation is really fast, then we can even go into tetanus as a result of that. All right, so that's one thing, the frequency of stimulation. The thickness of each muscle fiber. So what the heck is a muscle fiber again? It's a cell, it's a muscle cell. And what's the, in terms of contraction, what's the building block of a muscle cell? Okay, what are the organelles for contraction? The really long tubes, really long tubes. The myofibrils, right? And then the myofilaments make up the myofibrils, and within a myofibril, you got sarcomeres from end to end to end. All right, so on this point right here, the thickness of each muscle cell determines the tension that that muscle cell can produce, because as the muscle cell gets thicker and thicker and thicker, or as the diameter of the cell gets thicker and thicker and thicker, what happens to the number of myofibrils that make up that cell? It gets more, right? So as the cell gets thicker and thicker and thicker, or bigger and bigger and bigger in diameter, the cell can pack in more myofibrils. So it puts more organelles for contraction. So if you put more myofibrils inside the cell because they fit as the cell gets bigger, right, then that individual cell can produce more tension. That's all that this statement here says. So as each muscle cell gets bigger, it has more myofibrils, therefore it can produce more tension. All right, so that's kind of intuitive for me. Maybe if I go back, how far back do I have to go to see myofibrils? Here's a muscle cell with myofibrils, and how many myofibrils do I see in here? I see 9, right? And if we make the diameter of the cell bigger, right, then we can pack more of these myofibrils in there. Instead of 9, maybe 15 or 20, which then means that this muscle cell right here can produce more tension. Right? So as this muscle cell gets bigger, it gets stronger as a result. Right? So that's kind of intuitive to me. Now, what's not really intuitive is this last point right here. The initial length of a muscle fiber determines the tension that it can produce because it influences how that muscle cell can contract, how far it can contract. Right? The initial resting length, right, is that which can generate maximum force. So let's take a look at this slide right here. We have a plot of tension versus the resting length as a percentage, right, the resting length of a muscle cell. And so over here, the cell is relatively short, right, and over here, the muscle cell is kind of stretched out. And we see as the cell goes from a really short length, starts to get stretched out a little bit. As the cell starts to stretch out, what happens to the tension that that cell produces? It increases, right? It goes up a little bit. And then when you stretch the cell some more and then you stretch it a whole lot, what happens to the tension? It starts to go down again. So over here, the cell is overstretched, and over here, the cell is understretched. So let's see why this happens. Okay. And what is the structural and functional unit of contraction? It is the sarcomere, right? So that's, I want you to know that's the sarcomere. So the building block of a myofibril are all of the sarcomeres that line up from end to end. And what are the endpoints of a sarcomere again? The Z discs or the Z lines. And I see them right here. Here's a Z line and here's a Z line. And just for review, what filament attaches to the Z line? It's the actin, right? All right, so in this location right here, we see that the sarcomeres are very, very short. The Z discs are very close together. And what can you tell me about the overlap of actin and myosin in this condition when the muscle cell is not stretched out at all? There's a lot of overlap, right? There's a lot of overlap, so there's a possibility of a lot of interaction between myosin and actin, right, because there is overlap. But if there is cross-bridge cycling starting to happen right here, can this sarcomere get any shorter? Can it get any shorter? Well, this sarcomere can only get a little bit shorter by this little minuscule amount of the I-band right here, right, because these Z-discs really can't come any closer together because they're going to bump into the myosin molecule. So even cross bridges can cycle because maybe there's plenty of calcium and ATP in the cell. This sarcomere can't shorten because the myosin molecule, the myosin myofilament, is going to bump into the Z-disc. And if it can't shorten, it can't produce any tension. All right? So this muscle right here is understretched. Okay. So let's stretch that muscle out just a little bit. So now we pull the actin away from myosin a little bit. There still is some overlap between actin and myosin, so some cross bridges can form. Right? And then if we stimulate this muscle or let calcium flood the myofibril, can these filaments slide over each other? Oh, absolutely. Okay. So now the sarcomere can shorten and produce, okay, some tension when it does that. And this is almost the optimal arrangement between myosin and filament, myosin and actin. So you have some overlap between these two myofilaments, but still, right, the sarcomere can shorten by a lot. Let's look at the third case over here. So now the sarcomere is really long, so it can shorten quite a bit, right? It has the ability to shorten quite a bit. But now, do you see any overlap between actin and myosin? There's no overlap. So can any cross bridges develop? Yeah, since there's no overlap, this myosin can't interact with the myosin can't interact with the actin, and so actin can't slide over the myosin. So even though this sarcomere is really long and it can shorten quite a bit, there's nothing that will allow the sliding of the myofilaments over each other. So again, the muscle becomes very weak when that happens. So this just shows, right, at a nice myofilament level, a nice molecular level, that there has to be sufficient overlap between actin and myosin, but yet you still have to have some I-band right here, so that will allow the sarcomere to shorten and produce tension. So muscles, we see, can operate right on this ascending limb or in some optimal region right here, or they start to lose tension on the descending limb. So the descending limb and the ascending limb right here, the muscle loses the ability to produce tension because you don't have optimal overlap of actin and myosin myofilaments when the cell is at rest. And that's what we call the length-tension relationship. And we all know, what do athletes do before they exercise muscles? Yeah, they stretch out, right? And so they try to get, just by practice, get the optimal overlap between actin and myosin molecules so that those muscles can perform at peak tension. Okay. All right, so that's kind of important for athletes, but when we get to cardiac muscle in the next chapter, that's going to be a really important kind of concept for you to appreciate. So don't forget about this length-tension relationship. All right, so the heart will perform the same kind of way. Right, if the heart is not stretched out, what kind of tension will the heart produce when it tries to contract? Very little, okay? Or if the heart is overstretched, okay, what kind of tension will it produce when it tries to contract? Very little, right? So there has to be just the optimal amount of stretch within the myocardium to produce a maximal contraction. Okay, so when we get to the heart, we'll talk about that. Okay, neural control of skeletal muscles. We talked about autonomic nervous system in that last chapter. You just got tested on it. How many neurons does it take to go from central nervous system to an effector organ for the autonomic nervous system?
Two,
that's right. There's a ganglion in between. But for a somatic motor neuron, there's only one from the central nervous system, right? And sometimes that one is what we call a lower motor neuron. So it's just a final common pathway. That lower motor neuron can be receiving information from hundreds or thousands of other neurons within the central nervous system, in the spinal cord or coming down from the brain, okay? And they can all influence, right, this lower motor neuron. So that, and the activity of this lower motor neuron then is influenced by sensory feedback from muscles and tendons. So is feedback important to have control over biological systems that, as far as you're aware of in this class? Absolutely, right? So positive feedback, negative feedback, maintain homeostasis. Okay, so in order for your body to know if it's operating properly, it has to get information from a muscle, and that information should tell your central nervous system what the length of that muscle is all the time and what kind of tension it's producing, and if it's the proper kind of tension and length of that muscle, right, then that's what we call the set point. All right, so that information comes from, the feedback is controlled by the cerebellum, which can excite or inhibit the activity of these upper motor neurons to maintain proper muscle control. All right, so it comes from two important organs. Right, the muscle spindle apparatus in a muscle that's measuring the length of a muscle, and the Golgi tendon organ, which is a special kind of receptor organ that measures tension, and that comes from tendons. So you got length from the spindle apparatus and Golgi tendon organs from tendons that monitor tension. All right, so what we see right here, right, is a nice bone with a tendon. And here is the muscle itself. This could be like, I don't know, coracobrachialis or something. And here is the muscle spindle. It's not really drawn to scale. It's a microscopic receptor, so you can't really see it with your naked eye. So if we zoom into this region right here, this is what the muscle spindle actually looks like. And so on either side of the muscle spindle, you can see something that has all these striations in it. What does that look like to you? That just looks like a muscle fiber, and that's just a regular muscle fiber. And since we're considering this particular muscle spindle apparatus, this is what we call the extrafusal fibers, because they are outside the muscle spindle. Right? So these are extrafusal fibers. And we can also see some things that have striations inside the spindle apparatus. And what does that remind you of? That reminds you of a muscle, like a skeletal muscle, right? So there are some things within a spindle apparatus that can contract as well. And these are what we call the intrafusal fibers, right? So intrafusal fibers are inside the muscle spindle, and extrafusal fibers are on the outside. The intrafusal fibers really do not contribute to any tension that's produced by a muscle. The fibers that actually do the work for a muscle are these extrafusal ones, right? But the job of this spindle apparatus right here is to measure the length of a muscle when it's told to contract to see if it is actually contracting to the proper length. Okay. So what you need in order for these, in order to stimulate these extrafusal fibers or these regular skeletal muscles? You need some kind of nerve impulse coming down these somatic motor neurons. And for the purpose of this discussion, these are what we call alpha motor neurons that cause these skeletal muscle fibers to contract. All right? But there are also nerve fibers that go to the intrafusal fibers. Ah, here it is right here. Here are some somatic motor neurons that go to the intrafusal fibers, and these are what we call gamma motor neurons. So you got alpha going to the extrafusal fibers, gamma going to the intrafusal fibers, all right? But you also then have sensory neurons coming back from the muscle from these two different kinds of organs within the spindle apparatus, and I'm not going to ask you to know a lot of detail of the particulars of the muscle spindle apparatus right here, but since these are sensory nerves right here, these are the ones that are going to measure tension within the muscle. Okay, so let's take a look and see how this works. So when you want a muscle to contract, you send down action potentials to these extrafusal fibers that causes the muscle to contract. And what happens to the tension within the spindle apparatus if it doesn't contract while these contract over here? What happens to tension? So the muscle gets shorter, but this stays the same length. The tension decreases pretty rapidly. Right, so now there's a lot of slack in the muscle spindle right here because these extrafusal fibers have contracted, but the spindle stays the same length. So that just means that the extrafusal fibers can stretch quite a bit after that before any tension is applied to the spindle apparatus. All right, so what's important right here, in order for the spindle apparatus to actually monitor the amount of tension that's being produced, is that not only do the extrafusal fibers have to contract, but the intrafusal fibers also have to contract so that they match the length of the extrafusal fibers right here. All right, so they both contract together. So sometimes we call that coactivation of the extrafusal and intrafusal fibers. All right, so let's just say that this muscle is behaving exactly perfectly. It contracts the exact length in order for you to take a step or to maintain posture or whatever. And then all of a sudden, maybe your friend comes up to you and bonks you on the shoulder and muscles start to stretch. That's something that's unexpected. These muscles stretch, but now the spindle apparatus has contracted to the proper length. And if these extrafusal fibers start to stretch, what does that do to the spindle apparatus? It starts to stretch the spindle apparatus. It pulls it out of its shape that it should be in, all right, because it's been coactivated via this gamma neuron right here. And as they start to stretch, they send action potentials back up to the brain, particularly the cerebellum, right? And it's telling the cerebellum that the muscle is not at its proper length right now, that it's beginning to stretch. Right, and that is an error signal then that the cerebellum starts to correct, and even there are reflexes within the spinal cord, okay, that then say, oh, this muscle is stretching, we better protect that muscle and protect joints around it by contracting to get it back to its proper length. All right, so the spindle apparatus right here is just telling the central nervous system that the muscle is not at the length that you thought it was. It's at some kind of error. Okay, so you got alpha motor neurons, gamma motor neurons, and we talked about coactivation. So even right now, are you exercising any kind of muscle in your body? Yeah, just postural muscles, right? Okay. And so if nothing is disturbing your posture right now, right, then there is no error signal, and the spinal cord, cerebellum, really doesn't have any job to do. But if something were to happen to disturb your body position and muscles started to stretch, then the spindle apparatus would say, oh, muscles are stretching inappropriately, you're going to lose your balance, then the reflex loop is going to cause additional contraction of those extrafusal fibers to maintain your proper body position. All right, so let's take a look at this reflex right here, monosynaptic reflex. All right, so your leg is in a certain position. You could be standing, okay, but your knee has to be bent a little bit, so the rectus femoris or the quadriceps is doing some kind of job. And the, let's just say, rectus femoris is contracted to the proper length. All right, and what about this spindle apparatus right here? Is it just flaccid and loose inside the rectus femoris, or is it contracted to the proper length as well? Okay, because of coactivation, it is contracted to the proper length as well. So it's producing, so it's tight, right? It can't be stretched out without stimulating the receptor organs inside the spindle apparatus. All right, so now let's surprise you. Let's tap on this patellar ligament with this little hammer right here and apply tension to the patellar ligament, right, which applies tension to the patella, which applies tension to the tendon of the quadriceps. And when you apply tension to this tendon right here, it pulls on the quadriceps and starts to stretch it out, so the length changes. And since the length of the spindle apparatus has been set by coactivation, it gets stretched as well. All right. If the spindle apparatus was loose, you could pull on the quadriceps muscle and the tension, the change in length wouldn't be noticed by the spindle apparatus. Right? It has to be at the same length as the regular muscle fibers. So as the spindle apparatus becomes stretched, it sends signals up this sensory neuron right in through this dorsal root right here, and then immediately synapses on what this is what we call the lower motor neuron, which goes to the neuromuscular junction, and it's going to cause the quadriceps to contract to just correct for that error of that the stretching produced by this hammer right here, because the stretching was not anticipated by your central nervous system. It's something that wasn't ordered by the conscious control of this skeletal muscle right here. Because remember, skeletal muscles are under what? Conscious or voluntary control. The knock with this hammer was an involuntary stretch of a muscle, which is counteracted by this stretch reflex. All right, so this unconscious stretching of the quadriceps causes it to contract via this monosynaptic, or what we call knee-jerk reflex. The Golgi tendon organ reflex is a little bit different. That's a disynaptic reflex, and you have sensory receptors in tendons right here that measure tension, and it works a little bit differently. Right? As this muscle contracts, what is it producing from origin to insertion on this muscle when it contracts? It's producing tension in these tendons right here, which is picked up by the Golgi tendon apparatus. And as the tension increases, right, that increases the number of action potentials by the sensory neuron right here. And it synapses in an interneuron. And we know this is an interneuron because it's completely within the central nervous system. So this is an excitatory synapse. So as the tendon starts to produce tension, it excites this interneuron or association neuron, but this is an inhibitory neuron. It sends an inhibitory neurotransmitter to this somatic neuron. Then again, this is the lower motor neuron. And when this association neuron becomes excited, it inhibits the somatic motor neuron, which then causes relaxation of the muscle instead of excitation as with the knee-jerk reflex. So why is that? All right, again, that's going to protect this muscle and joints. So in this particular case, when does this reflex get activated? Well, maybe you've been asked to help somebody move sometime or another, okay? And they've got a big couch or a big TV set or a refrigerator or something, right? And it's just you and another person holding up a couch, and you start to walk across the floor. You're both holding up this couch, and then all of a sudden the couch slips out of the hands of the person that's helping you, right? So instead of holding up half the couch, what are you holding up now all by yourself? The whole weight of the couch, right? So all this weight now is applied to various muscles, and it could be so heavy that it could start to rip these muscles and rip these tendons out of their insertions and origins, all right? But that doesn't happen because as the tension gets higher and higher and higher, what's going to happen to those muscles that you are using to hold that couch up? They're going to be inhibited, and you're going to drop your end of the couch as well, right? Protecting all of those origins and insertions and this muscle right here from being damaged as a result of all of a sudden all of that tension being placed on it. All right, so that's inherently a little bit different kind of mechanism compared to the stretch reflex. All right, so the Golgi tendon organ reflexes prevents overproduction of tension on your musculoskeletal system so it doesn't become damaged. The stretch reflex right here is different because this muscle doesn't relax. It contracts to go back to its position, right, of contraction before it was stretched. So in one case, right, the stretch reflex prevents stretching, and the tension reflex of the Golgi tendon reflex right here prevents what? Over contraction and the production of too much tension on your musculoskeletal system, and that protects it from damage. All right, so that's pretty much it for skeletal muscles. So make sure you kind of know the neuroanatomy between those two different reflexes. Cardiac and smooth muscle. So there are some similarities and some differences compared to skeletal muscle. All right, the biggest similarity is that cardiac muscle and smooth muscle is still specialized to do what? To contract, just like skeletal muscle. Okay, and in skeletal muscle, you've got the neuromuscular junction. What kind of synapse is that? What kind of synapse is a neuromuscular? Yeah, it's a chemical synapse. All right, so let's talk about cardiac muscle first, and then we'll talk about smooth muscle. Here I see a nice picture of cardiac muscle, and could you tell this is cardiac muscle and that skeletal muscle? Okay, because of the branched, all these muscle cells right here are branched and they're relatively short. So here's the end of one cell, here's the end of that same cell on the other end, so they're very short. So we usually don't call these fibers because they're not long and linear like skeletal muscle cells, right? So we just call these myocardial cells. And so when this muscle here contracts, it has to pull on a neighboring cell to produce tension within the whole heart. So there are certain specializations in this area that we call the intercalated disc, right? So there are special adherence junctions that glue these cells together. But there are also other special kind of junctions that we call gap junctions. And these are just tunnels for sodium ions to travel through, right? So that if this top cell on the left, if we cause depolarization due to an influx of sodium into the cell, causing depolarization and stimulation of this cell, then sodium can move into this neighboring cell on the right via the gap junctions. Then what happens to this cell on the right over here? It depolarizes, becomes excited, right, and it starts to contract, right? So the cells in this top layer, all of these cells will become excited at the same time. But because these are branched cells, All right, and let's look at the next cell down below it. Say this cell over here becomes depolarized. What happens to this cell down below it? Because of the branch nature of myocardial cells, it starts to depolarize and contract as well. So that when one cell in the heart depolarizes, not only the cells that are neighbors right to left depolarize, but cells that are neighbors from top to bottom also become excited and contract. Right, so the whole myocardium contracts from right to left, top to bottom. So sometimes if we think about the whole wall thickness, we call that the transmural contraction. Right, it goes from the superficial to deep layers of the heart itself. And that happens because these cells are branched and the cells have gap junctions. So the heart should contract as a unit, and it can because of these gap junctions right here. All right, what are some other differences? Well, cardiac muscle is striated, so it has sarcomeres, and so you kind of know why a myocardial cell contracts. But since they're short, they only have their progenitor cells were just a single cell during development, so they only have one nucleus. But unlike skeletal muscle cells, these are involuntary. Right? You don't really control when your heart contracts. It's controlled by your autonomic nervous system and also by some just intrinsic properties of these cells by themselves. So the heart muscle doesn't even need innervation to contract. It will contract at its own particular rhythm, which we'll talk about probably in the next in two chapters coming up. Okay, so action potentials flow over all of the myocardial cells. So here is a nice myocardial cell, and I can see Z discs, right? So heart muscle is striated, and it's got myosin and actin pretty much in the same kind of arrangement. And you can see the myosin head group right here. It's got to interact with the actin. And it's controlled through the same mechanism via calcium. Calcium binds to troponin, which gets tropomyosin out of the way. Then cross bridges can cycle, and the heart can contract. Okay, so here is a nice plasma membrane, and notice in this particular example, we have calcium channels that go to the outside of the cell, right? And where is calcium at a high concentration, intracellular or extracellular? Extracellular. So here is a nice voltage-gated calcium channel so that when an action potential flows over the myocardial cell, right, these channels open up, so some calcium comes into the cell from the outside world, from the extracellular space. So that's a pretty big difference compared to skeletal muscle. Right, there really aren't any calcium channels in the cell membrane of a skeletal muscle cell that open up. It's only calcium channels in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so the heart contracts partly because of extracellular calcium. But the heart also does have sarcoplasmic reticulum with high calcium, and it has calcium-induced release channels right here, which are operated not through the ryanodine receptor, but because of extracellular calcium entering the cell that opens up these calcium-induced channels right here. So there's no mechanical coupling between an action potential that's on the cell membrane and the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so these calcium-induced calcium release channels are really big, so a lot of calcium floods the myofibrils, and then cross bridges start to cycle. But these right here are triggered not by an action potential on the cell membrane or transverse tubule, but by calcium entering the cell. So for a myocardial cell, calcium is important for two reasons, right? Extracellular calcium is important, as well as calcium inside the sarcoplasmic reticulum. There are two sources. And in skeletal muscle, there's only that one source. Then the heart relaxes when this calcium ATP pump pumps calcium back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum and also back to the extracellular fluid as well. Then the heart relaxes. All right, so that's probably one of the biggest differences between skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle. In smooth muscle, there is a big difference between skeletal muscle. So here is a smooth muscle cell, and again, we typically don't call these fibers, although these are kind of long and narrow like a skeletal muscle cell. They're not branched. They have one nucleus. These are also under involuntary control, right? They're influenced by your autonomic nervous system, not by a somatic motor neuron. And do you see any striations in this smooth muscle cell? There are no striations. So this means that there are no sarcomeres. So if a cell doesn't have sarcomeres, you might wonder, well, how does it contract? Because what is a smooth muscle cell specialized to do? It's specialized to contract. Well, it still has myofilaments. It still has actin and myosin. And what do actin and myosin do? They slide over each other under the proper control. All right, so let's look at the arrangement of the thing that's replacing a sarcomere. On the surface of the cell, there are dense bodies. These are proteins that are anchored into the cell membrane. And also anchored into these dense bodies are actin filaments. All right, so this is just a point. It's not a disc or a line. It's just a point, and it has a number of actin molecules. And before you get to the next dense body on the cell membrane, right, these are interleaved with myosin molecules. But notice this arrangement. They don't line up perfectly like the sarcomeres do in skeletal muscle. And since all these actin and myosin molecules form more like a network over the surface of the cell, you don't see striations in this particular cell, the smooth muscle cell, but you still have overlap of actin and myosin. And the nature of the myosin molecule is quite different. It has many more actin molecules surrounding it, and there are more cross bridges packed into a tighter region within smooth muscle cells. And this allows a greater shortening of this smooth muscle cell, okay, and it's also easier to stretch a smooth muscle cell as well. Another big difference is that this myosin group right here has to hydrolyze ATP, just like in cardiac and smooth muscle, but that ATPase is a lot slower. It takes a longer time to release the energy for ATP, so the rate of shortening is also a lot slower for smooth muscle compared to skeletal and cardiac muscle. So once a smooth muscle is stimulated into contraction, instead of contracting immediately, it takes a little while for it to contract. All right, it's much slower as a result of that. All right, so let's look at this figure right here and then maybe go back to some of these word slides. All right, so this is what I want you to know about excitation-contraction coupling. Some smooth muscles generate their own electrical activity. So these are graded depolarizations. Right, and you can see them building on each other. So this first one right here, how would you classify this graded depolarization right here? It is subthreshold, right, because here's the threshold. It's subthreshold. What about the second graded depolarization? It's subthreshold as well. And this third graded depolarization reaches threshold, so that's going to start action potentials on the cell surface membrane. Okay, and these action potentials depolarize the interior of the cell. That opens voltage-gated channels on the plasma membrane. And in smooth muscle cells, you really don't have very much in the way of smooth endoplasmic reticulum. All right, so the calcium that is going to cause contraction of a smooth muscle cell is going to be extracellular because of these voltage-gated calcium channels on the plasma membrane. So smooth muscle cells don't have calcium-induced calcium release channels or ryanodine or DHP channels, and then because it doesn't have sarcoplasmic reticulum that's storing calcium. And does that make sense, that calcium is going to enter the cell from the extracellular fluid? Yeah, because as you learned way back when, calcium is at a high concentration, at least in the normal individual, extracellularly. All right, so when you have these action potentials, that opens voltage-gated channels, and this calcium here doesn't bind to troponin, like in cardiac and skeletal muscle. It binds to that cousin molecule that we call calmodulin that can modulate the activity of enzymes inside the cell. So here's a calcium calmodulin complex, right? And it's going to bump into a enzyme called MLCK. That stands for myosin light chain kinase. All right, so you've heard of myosin before. It's part of that big, thick filament, right? And what does a kinase do? It phosphorylates something, right? So it's going to run around phosphorylating when it becomes activated. And it's called light chain right here because myosin also has some, guess what? Heavy chains, right? So it's not light like a flashlight. It's just what? It's just the lighter of some parts of a protein that make up the myosin molecule inside these cells. And this myosin light chain kinase is normally inactive. It's inactive because it has been phosphorylated, right? But when it bumps into this Calmodulin calcium complex, it becomes dephosphorylated and it becomes in an active form as a result of that. So it's easy to dephosphorylate something. Okay, so now you've got myosin light chain kinase. It's active. And what does a kinase do? It phosphorylates something, and it phosphorylates the myosin molecule. All right, so the myosin becomes phosphorylated, and when myosin becomes phosphorylated, cross bridges can form. And when cross bridges can form, what happens to actin and myosin? They slide over each other, right? And when they slide over each other, what about those dense bodies that are all over the surface of the cell? They get pulled together. So there's like a net that then gets pulled closer and closer together. All the dense bodies get squeezed closer together, and that causes that smooth muscle cell to contract, right, from tip to tip and also from end to end. All right, so that's what a kinase does. And what is what's an enzyme that's antagonistic to a kinase? A phosphatase, right? All right, so you might wonder, how is it that a smooth muscle cell relaxes? And that's because there is a myosin phosphatase that is active inside of a smooth muscle cell, and that's going to dephosphorylate this myosin light chain, and when it's dephosphorylated, cross bridges cannot form, and the smooth muscle starts to activate. And it just so happens that this myosin phosphatase is controlled by a phosphorylation as well. Okay, so you can see the inactive form is phosphorylated, and the active form of myosin phosphatase is not phosphorylated, just like the myosin light chain kinase right here. Okay, so that's kind of handy to see that they're operating through the same way. Okay, so this metabolic process is a lot longer than, right, it's much more involved compared to the excitation-contraction coupling that we've seen in skeletal muscle, and this is why smooth muscle just takes longer to contract because you have to activate and deactivate a number of enzymes within smooth muscle cells. Plus, also don't forget that this myosin ATP, it needs ATP for cross-bridge cycling. This myosin ATP is also a slower kind of ATPase, which means that the cross-bridges can't cycle quite as fast compared to skeletal and cardiac muscle. All right, so that's what we just went over is everything that's in these two slides right here, right? So smooth muscle is controlled by calcium, right? But it's different than from striated muscle, like cardiac and skeletal muscle, right? It really, smooth muscle doesn't have endoplasmic reticulum. It doesn't have troponin and tropomyosin, right? What does it have instead of troponin that can bind calcium? It has calmodulin. Right, and calmodulin directly activates a kinase enzyme, right, and that kinase enzyme phosphorylates myosin, which then activates myosin, and that allows cross bridges to form, and actin and myosin slide over each other. So smooth muscle still has actin and myosin; it's just in a little bit different state. All right, and then when myosin becomes dephosphorylated due to myosin phosphatase, myosin could no longer form cross bridges, and then it starts to relax. There are some interesting properties for smooth muscle because of the different architecture inside the cell. It can go into a state almost like rigor mortis. We call it a latch state, and this state, the smooth muscle can stay contracted for long periods of time without using up any ATP inside the cell. Right, so we call that the latch state, so it can maintain force while using very little energy. And that's probably one important thing that maintains, for instance, when does a smooth muscle stay contracted for maybe 9 months? Like during gestation, right? The uterus has to stay contracted, okay, for long periods of time And so it has adapted so it can stay contracted for a long period of time without using up a lot of ATP. Okay, smooth muscle generally can be broken down into a couple different kinds. Single unit and multi-unit smooth muscle. Single unit has gap junctions between them. All right, so a single unit type of smooth muscle, if one muscle cell contracts in that whole smooth muscle arrangement, what happens to all the smooth muscles? Since it has gap junctions, they all contract, hence the name single unit, right? So all of the muscle fibers or muscle cells in that particular organ are going to contract, or at least in that one region. Some of the cells can be pacemakers. That means that they will just spontaneously depolarize to threshold, which means then all of those smooth muscles in that region are going to contract due to the depolarization of a pacemaker cell someplace. Okay, multi-unit, on the other hand, requires nerve stimulation by the autonomic nervous system. It requires release of neurotransmitters from some kind of synapse. And let's take a look at some of these synapses. So here's a nice picture that shows smooth muscle cells with gap junctions. So what are going to happen to all of these smooth muscle cells if this cell where the cursor is depolarizes? If this cell depolarizes to threshold, then all of these smooth muscle cells, okay, are going to depolarize to threshold and contract. And so with that, if they all contract together, is that going to be multi-unit or single-unit smooth muscle? That's a really good example of single-unit smooth muscle. They're all going to contract. A good example of that would be smooth muscle in the digestive tract, right? So that if one muscle cell contracts, then this whole ring around the intestines is going to contract, and that's very important for peristalsis in terms of moving digesting material through the intestinal tract. All right, so these muscle cells down here don't actually need innervation because they're controlled by their neighboring cells. Now, here is a nice multipolar neuron, and I don't see the end of the axon that has the normal synaptic endings and synaptic terminals, but I do see some swellings periodically along the axon. All right, and so these are acting like the Bouton terminale in a regular kind of motor neuron that you're aware of. So there are synaptic vesicles in this area. So when an action potential flows over this axon, it's going to release neurotransmitter from each one of these swellings right here, and these are what we call varicosities. All right, and it's going to release neurotransmitter, and these smooth muscle cells right here and right here have ligand-gated channels throughout their whole region, not just underneath the varicosity right here. Remember, a skeletal muscle only has ligand-gated channels within the neuromuscular junction, and that's it. But ligand-gated channels in smooth muscle, right, are populated within throughout the whole cell membrane. Right, so when acetylcholine is released from this autonomic neuron, then it's going to cause these muscles to contract. Right, and so what's the effect of So here's the postganglionic neuron. Which postganglionic neuron is excitatory on the digestive system? Is it sympathetic or parasympathetic stimulation? Yeah, parasympathetic. All right, so here is a parasympathetic neuron, okay, releasing acetylcholine, and that's going to cause excitation of the digestive tract right here. For multi-unit smooth muscle, okay, for instance in the eye, right, this is multi-unit because it's missing what these membrane intercell connections called gap junctions, right? So they're going to be stimulated directly by neurotransmitter from these varicosities, from these autonomic neurons right here. A good example would be the iris for this particular example. So sometimes we call these synapses in passant because as an action potential passes by, it releases neurotransmitter pretty much from the whole length of the axon, not just the axon terminus. Okay. And I think that's all I got to say about smooth muscle. Okay. All right, so next time, we didn't get to it. Next time, we get to talk about blood and some things about the heart. So if you need to go back and review your heart anatomy, you have a lot of slides on heart anatomy that I gave to you as PowerPoints, but we're not going to go over because you should really know that from anatomy. Like, for instance, how many chambers does a heart have?
Four.
How many valves does a heart have? That should be right on the tip of your tongue. How many chambers? Four. How many valves? Four valves. Okay, so get to remember what valves are which, where they're located.